1 Corinthians 14:26 through 14:40, the 41st talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on July 25, 2004, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. We'll be starting with verse 26. The passage that we're looking at today is a challenging one for me to teach. As we've been going through 1 Corinthians, what we have seen, at least from my perspective, is that the 12, 13, and 14, the principles involved, the values that Paul is trying to get the Corinthians to embrace and to live out in the midst of the particular situation that he's talking about, I think those principles are very clear and they're very important. I actually like this section a lot, 12 through 14. It has a lot in it that has a lot more to do than just spiritual gifts or speaking in tongues or that sort of thing. It's an entire perspective on what the most important things are. And I've tried to bring that out as we've gone along. The problem is, as we've seen, that there is something particular going on in Corinth. There is a practice that they refer to as speaking in tongues. There is this practice that is referred to as prophecy, and the hard part is for us to know what exactly is going on with those things. What was this practice, and what is it that Paul's saying about it? So the principles involved in terms of what we're supposed to take away and see about the value of things, it's fairly easy to see what's going on, but it is challenging to figure out what exactly is he talking about. Well, the problem with the passages that we're going to look at today is that it's heavy on those details that I don't know what's going on, and a little lighter on the principles that we're trying to bring out here. So not knowing exactly what it is that's going on in Corinth makes it challenging to figure out what's going on with this section. So I just have to warn you that I'm going to be doing a lot of explaining and a lot of punting as we go along through this section. And then next week, I'm going to take one last time to kind of look back over the whole section and try to speak to this question of what should we understand tongues to be, prophecy, and spiritual gifts in general. And as I've been warning you all along, that's going to be a very tentative assessment. But I want to take us through this section, see what we can see, and then you'll notice the questions that I'm putting aside as we go along. It says, what does it come down to, brethren? When you assemble, each one has a psalm, has a teaching, has a revelation, has a tongue, has a translation. Let all things be done for edification. Okay. So, Paul is now going to apply this overall principle that he has been appealing to as he's been going along, this idea that the purpose of our getting together is to edify one another, to build up one another, to remind each other of the truth and encourage one another to persevere in the faith and to be courageous in the face of the difficulties of life because of the truth of the gospel and so on. Paul gives this list. Now, I think we need to understand this list correctly. He is not saying, here is the list of all of the stuff that you have to have in the best sort of worship service. He's saying, this is what you guys do when you get together. Now, given that you do these things, I want you to make sure that everything you're doing is for edification. Like tongues is on the list, and Paul has already made it clear and is going to make it clear, even more clear as he goes into it, that actually it's unlikely that tongues has any place in an assembly of Christians together unless there is the possibility that someone can actually translate it and explain what it is that was being said. So this is not his list of make sure you have somebody speaking in tongues. He's saying, look, this is what goes on. When you guys get together, you have people doing these various things. What I want to make sure is that you're doing these various things is being done from the perspective that the goal is to edify one another. We can talk quickly about the things in the list. He mentions someone having a psalm. It was their practice, I think, to sing psalms from the Old Testament. Paul speaks of this in two other places, and the same themes emerge in both of those places, which fit very well with what he's talking about here. First of all, we see that Paul sees the singing of the psalm as a way of communicating with each other, encouraging each other with what we are singing. And in the two places he talks about it, he uses the language speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And in the other place he talks about it, he says, let the word of Christ richly dwell within you, with all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. So Paul sees this singing that is happening, whether it is one person singing the song or one person leading everybody in singing the psalm, that the idea is this edification that he has been talking about. The singing is an edifying thing to do. We are speaking to each other with wisdom and encouragement and admonishment when we're singing these songs. He also, both times, connects the singing of these psalms with gratitude. He says, always giving thanks for all things. And in the other context, he says, singing with thankfulness in your hearts to God. So Paul sees this activity, when they get together, there is someone who is prepared to sing or lead them in singing a psalm. He sees this as an edifying sort of thing. We are speaking to each other and reminding each other of the truth. And we are doing it out of gratitude. That is, the truths that we are singing and reminding ourselves of remind us that God is good, that whatever difficulty is going on in our lives, in fact, we have much to be grateful for. We are the heirs of life, and we ought to be grateful for that. So that's how he sees psalms, the singing of a psalm. He talks about someone having a teaching. We know that Paul saw teaching as one of the gifts of the Spirit, and remember he had listed in kind of the order of occurrence and priority, I think, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers. So it makes sense that he would have seen that there would be someone prepared to teach something to the group. Now we have to remember that they didn't have the New Testament yet, so I would imagine that the way things looked would have been quite different than what we are used to. The teaching would have to be something from the Old Testament or word of mouth. We have heard that Jesus said this, reminding each other what it is the tradition has said that Jesus told us, without perhaps yet actually having written text of the New Testament to refer to. The sort of thing that I am doing here, going back to Paul's letters, to Paul's authoritative letters to the Corinthians, and trying to explain this is how Paul saw things based on what we see in the letter, that's not the sort of thing that a teacher probably would have been doing at that point, but it would have been in the same spirit, I think. And then he talks about someone coming with a revelation or a tongue or a translation or interpretation. Now, this gets us right into the heart of that question that I have been dodging, and I'm still going to dodge it today. Exactly what do we understand prophecy to be? Revelation seems to be connected with prophecy. At least he connects the two in a few verses here. Tongues, as we've been saying all along, the question is, what exactly was this practice? Is it the practice of speaking a language that I don't know? I set out to speak in English and it comes out in Lithuanian or something like that. Is it the language of the angels? Is it just some sort of a pre-articulate grunt of my soul? I mean, what exactly is it that we understand this to be? And as I say, I'll try to address that as best I can next week. But These are the areas where Paul wants to give them some guidelines. They have people speaking in tongues, whatever it is. They have prophecy going on, whatever that is. And he wants them to approach it from the perspective of having it being edifying to the congregation. And that's the part we want to emphasize this morning. Paul is going to go on to address three situations. He's going to talk about tongues, he's going to talk about prophecy, and totally out of the blue in a very difficult to understand passage, he talks about women. Now, there is a thread that ties them together, and I think it is genuinely a thread that ties them together. In each one of those three situations, he tells someone to keep silent. And I think what Paul is trying to do is to speak into what he sees happening. There's a lot of talking going on. People are speaking in tongues. There are prophets battling for the floor. There's something going on with the women in Corinth that we don't exactly know what it is, but there's something's going on there. And all of it has to do with, in the assembly, this cacophony of voices competing to be heard somehow. And Paul is basically telling a whole group of folks, here's how you can tell what you ought to do. If what you're doing is not contributing to the building up of the rest of the group, then shut up. That's basically his advice in the rest of this stuff. If it's not helping, then be quiet. And three times he says, keep silent. I think that is what ties these three things together, at least. And there may be some more as well as we go along here. So, his first point, if anyone speaks in a tongue, it should be by two, or at the most three, and each in turn, and let one translate. But if there is no translator, let him keep silent in the church, and let him speak to himself and to God. Okay, so, I'm not going to say a lot about this section here. I'm going to address that what are we talking about with tongues question next week. But whatever we understand tongues to be, his concern is clear. If you are going to have tongue speaking in the assembly of believers, there are limitations that I want there to be on this. First of all, I only want a couple of them, two or three. You go one at a time, and it must be translated to be edifying. There has to be someone who can say what it was that you were just saying. And if you don't have anybody who can say what it was that you were just saying, then keep silent. There's our first keep silent. Paul is not forbidding tongues, but he's saying, I don't want them in the assembly unless it is tied to content that is edifying. Unless someone can actually articulate what it was that was being said there, don't do it. Do it yourself. Do it privately, where you speak, and the one doing that then can speak to himself and to God. If you can't say something that the rest of the group can profit from, then do it privately and talk to God and yourself. That's his point here. So, and this is just a continuation of what we've seen all along. Chapter 14 has been big on this issue of the whole point is edification, building up and encouraging. So if you can't articulate what it is you're saying, then don't do it in the group. It just alienates people and leads to disorder. We do have this clue that we'll try to follow up next time. This person speaking tongues speaks to two people, to God and to himself, in Paul's view. And we'll have to try to understand what it is he means by that. Okay, but the key here is edification and order. We don't want this chaos of voices. We want one at a time points that can be understood by everybody. His next point. And let two or three prophets speak, and let the others sort them out. But if a revelation is made to another who is seated, let the first keep silent. For you all are able to prophesy one by one, so that all may learn and all may be encouraged. And the spirits of prophets are subject to prophets. For God is not a God of disorder, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. Okay, now once again we run into this problem. what exactly is prophecy? And again, I'm going to try to address that question next week. If you all have, you know, like you're trying to schedule a vacation or something, next week might be a good time for that. But, no, I'm going to say something, but it's just not entirely satisfying to me. I have felt quite good about what we've been talking about in the section because there's a lot of good stuff, I think, and I feel like I understand what it's saying and the points are really important. So it's a little bit unsatisfying as a teacher to come to the final talk on the whole thing to kind of say, well, I don't know, might be this, it might be that. But that's what it's going to come down to in the end. So I'm just telling you, that's what it's going to be like next week. But you'll understand a little better the choices that have to be made and how we might think about it. I can promise you that. But that's about all I can promise you. So we run into that problem here with prophecy. What exactly do we understand him to be talking about? And the details here, how you sort them out, depends on how you picture what prophecy is. You can interpret them in several different ways. But whatever it is, and we'll try to address that next week, Paul's concern, once again, is for order and edification. First of all, let's have two or three do this. Then others are going to sort them out. They're going to distinguish between is the idea. Presumably, what he's saying is that it's a prophet speaking is subject to others then making some sort of assessment whether this was actually worth listening to or not. Now, exactly what the details are of that and how that might work itself out, we'll talk about that next week. But that's one of the things that Paul is concerned with here. And it is interesting that he is concerned that there be a discerning judgment made of these prophetic utterances, whatever they might be. Now, it seems to me that something like this must be going on, though. Because of what he says, that the spirits of prophets are subject to prophets and all of that, I think that what's happening in Corinth is that the Corinthians are very interested in these manifestations of the Spirit. They were very interested in tongues because, as Paul makes the allusion in the very first, in chapter 12, they had a background of this sort of thing in their pagan background, where they went before the dumb idols and were carried away. And I think the Corinthians must see prophecy as this sort of thing as well. Just as speaking in tongues is, wow, my mouth is under control of the Spirit. I think that they must have seen prophecy to be a similar sort of thing. A prophetic utterance has come upon me and I have to blurt it out. So you have someone talking and then someone else gets a prophetic utterance and they start talking and pretty soon you've got all of these voices shouting things out various places. And I have to keep talking, of course, because I'm just in control of the Spirit and it just has to come out. And so what you end up with in this situation is chaos. So I think what Paul is saying is, however we understand what prophecy to be, the Corinthians seem to have a picture of it that it is this out-of-control phenomenon. And what he's saying to them here is, no, it's not. The spirits of prophets are subject to prophets. The prophet is in control of what's going on. He can decide whether to speak or not. You all are able to prophesy one by one. It is not outside of your control. You can have one person speak and then another person speak. This is doable. It's not that God has got a hold of you and is forcing you against your will to add another voice to the voices that are out there so that we've got everybody shouting at the same time or something like that. For God is not a God of disorder, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. So I think that's the kind of thing that Paul's concerned with. What he is saying here is, what we want is prophets speaking one by one and their message being evaluated by the group somehow. That's what we want. This can edify. They say something that you can hear and understand because just one at a time they're speaking. And then we decide the value of what it is that they said so that we can decide what to do with it ultimately. What are we going to take away from this? That's what Paul wants to see happening, and his concern is that this picture that it's somehow, how can we think that God is behind what you're doing when it leads to chaos and disorder? God is not a God of disorder. He is not operating among you in such a way that you can't help but have this chaos going on. That's not the way God operates. So that's his concern. Now, what specifically is prophecy? What do they think it is? What does Paul think it is? And all of that, I'll try to address that next week. But again, his concern here is that there can't be any edification if you have several people shouting out these messages at the same time as if they can't help it because the Spirit has got a hold of them. Where is the edification in that? How can people learn from something like that? But if you prophesy one by one, which everyone is able to do, whatever prophecy is, but we know it has content, then people can understand the content. I can hear you, and then I can hear you, and then I can hear you, and so I can take in what it is that's being said. We'll talk next time about the strange fact. I mean, it's another one of the clues in trying to sort this out, that when Paul says when a revelation happens to someone sitting down, that the one who's talking should stop. I would have thought, you know, if I were going to promote order, I would have said the guy who gets the revelation should wait till the first guy's done and then start. But the idea that somehow the guy who's talking should shut up and the guy who got the revelation should talk, that's different than what I would have expected and implies a certain picture of why did Paul put the priority there. And we'll have to talk about that next week. But clearly what the value that he's concerned with here, his priority is that there be order in order that there may be edification. The order makes it possible for ideas to be talked about and understood and be encouraging and so on. Okay, now we get to the third one. And this one is, I mean, if you thought I was dancing with the first two, now, you know, I'm going to do my Fred Astaire bit now. Let the women keep silent in the churches, for it is not permitted that they speak, but let them subject themselves, just as the law also says. And if they desire to learn something, let them question their own husbands at home, for it is improper for a woman to speak in church. Okay. Obviously, this is a difficult and controversial couple of verses. It is both difficult and controversial. The difficulty relates to the question of, first of all, what is it doing here? I mean, many people have observed that if you were to take these couple of verses and pull them out, the flow of thought would work very well. I mean, it sounds like an interruption to what it is he has been talking about. Because he talks about prophets on either side of this, but now we're talking about women. And what does that have to do with what it is that he has been discussing? There is a manuscript that has this section in a different spot in 1 Corinthians than the place it has now. And you can understand why somebody might have done that, because it really sort of seems stuck in a certain way of thinking in the spot where it is. Because of that fact that a manuscript has it in another spot, there are those, probably most famously Gordon Fee in his quite good commentary on 1 Corinthians actually, has made the controversial argument that this is a textual corruption, that somebody stuck it in and that it's not Paul. The fact that we have it most manuscripts here, but in another manuscript somewhere else, he thinks, you know, it was kind of written in the margins of something somewhere and it varied as to where people stuck it in. I don't think the evidence is very strong for that. And in the reading I've done, the best that I can come up with at this point is that I don't think that there is strong evidence that there is textual corruption here. I think this is Paul and it is where we find it in our text. That would be my conclusion right now. So, given that fact, I think we need to try to understand what it is that Paul's saying. The best I can do here is to make a series of observations that I think will help us narrow in on what it is that Paul is getting at. These observations, well, you'll see. I think these observations are very helpful. I would argue that these are things that we have to take into account as we put this together. Observation number one, as is often pointed out by people, earlier in 1 Corinthians, Paul told married women to keep their heads covered when they prayed or prophesied in the assembly. So if Paul is saying here, women should not speak in the church, as in what it sounds like, women should not speak in the church. Their voices should not be heard by the rest of the people in the assembly. Then why is it that earlier he was saying when they pray or prophesy, they should have their heads covered? And that seems to me pretty strong, because it would have been very easy for Paul at the point where he was addressing the problem of the head coverings to say, you know, there's a simple solution to this. These women should not be talking at all. Don't you know that? They're not supposed to be speaking. But he didn't say that. So I think that would suggest to us that Paul has in mind not any sort of speech, but that there is a particular kind of speech that fits the context that we're talking about here, that he is saying that the women shouldn't be doing. In order to make sense out of the whole book, it seems to me that we have to make a move like that. And so our first thought might be, aha, I know, the context is prophecy, so it's saying that women shouldn't prophesy. But then, of course, the problem is in chapter 11, he said when they're praying or prophesying. So that's not going to work either. Okay, observation number two. This is the third time that Paul has told someone to keep silent in the church. In each of these three things, he tells someone, for the sake of a certain order, for the sake of edification, that if there is a problem here, if what's happening is promoting disorder and not promoting edification, then someone should keep silent. And so I think that is significant. The overall context is, when you get together, do everything for edification and not disorder. Don't have multiple people speaking in tongues at the same time and with no translation of what's going on. Don't have multiple prophets shouting out their prophecies at the same time. In each of those cases, if that's what's happening, keep silent. And now, he's saying to the women, keep silent. So, it would make sense that Paul, knowing the situation into which he's writing, and we don't know the situation into which he's writing, sees something about the situation that is promoting that same sort of disorder and lack of edification that he was seeing in the other situations. Observation number three. Paul contrasts their speaking with let them subject themselves. That is, he says, let the women keep silent in the churches, for it is not permitted that they speak, but let them subject themselves. And I think this is very important. This is language that Paul uses in several other passages when he talks about women, talking about them being subjects, subjecting themselves to their husbands. I presume, then, that whatever it is that's happening in this situation, he is saying it is not permitted that they speak, but rather they should subject themselves. That there is something in this situation that their speaking represents a refusal to be subject to who they ought to be subject to. And presumably it has to do with the men and their husbands and something along those lines. Now, I don't have a lot of time to go into it here. This is not a great passage, actually, to talk about the issue of women and their role in the church and that kind of thing, because it's so cryptic and short. And if we were to try to understand what kind of subjection does Paul have in mind when he talks about women, we have to look at other passages that are more complete, tell us more about what it is that Paul thinks. I have argued in the past, just very briefly, and I know this isn't going to be enough. If you haven't heard me talk about this before, this will not be enough to really sort this out. But I have argued that Paul sees certain areas as being the prior responsibility of the husband in marriage. He makes this argument going back to the created order, arguing that Adam had certain responsibilities that were given to him and that Eve was given to him as a helper that corresponded to him. Now, this is a limited area from my perspective, that everyone has personal responsibility for their own choices and their own lives, and no husband can dictate to his wife what she ought to do with her personal choices and the areas that she is responsible for herself, but that there is an area of group where the group is involved, where responsibility rests with someone to set the course of things, and it is appropriate for the person who does not have the responsibility for that to acknowledge and submit to the person who does have the responsibility for it. Authority goes with responsibility. But ultimately, there are certain aspects of the joint projects that a family is taking on that the husband will be answerable before God for, and therefore it is appropriate for the authority to rest with him. Now, we could go into all the implications of that, and this is not the time for it, I don't think. But basically, I want you to understand that it is this limited area of the group where there is a prior responsibility for someone, and the man. And I think that the implications of this in Paul's mind extend to the church. It is inappropriate for the wives to be taking upon themselves the kind of leadership where they are basically disputing and calling the shots for their husbands who are in leadership, something like that. Now, there's a lot that we could go into there, but that's the idea of subjection that Paul talks about in other places, and I think that's what he has in mind here, although he doesn't explain it. But this, the women have a responsibility for a certain sort of recognition of the authority of their husbands in certain areas, and whatever is happening here in Corinth, their speaking out represents their refusal to acknowledge that. They will not submit to a certain restriction here that God would say the responsibility rests with their husbands, and so they ought to be submitting to that. Something along those lines. I'm putting the emphasis here, I think it's an important thing to see that he talks about this idea of subjecting themselves. Some propose that the problem is that the men are sitting on one side and the women are sitting on the other side, and the women are calling out to their husbands, "Hey, I didn't understand. What did he mean by that?" And then he yells back, "Well, he meant this." And Paul's saying, "No, ask your questions at home." But I don't think that's enough. That's not a big enough problem given the kind of thing that Paul's talking about here, because the issue is an unwillingness to subject yourself, to recognize that someone else has authority. So I think the issue has to revolve around that somehow. Observation number 4. People often point out that the law does not say that women should be silent in the assembly, and that's true. But I don't think that's what Paul's arguing here. What he says is, let them subject themselves, as the law says. We have already seen earlier in 1 Corinthians that Paul makes his case for male headship by appealing to the scriptures, by appealing to Genesis and to the order of things that set out in Genesis with Adam and Eve. So I think he's just alluding to that. He is not saying that the law says that women have to be quiet in assemblies. He's saying that the law says, the scriptures say, that it is appropriate for a woman to subject herself to a proper authority. That's what it is that he's saying that the law says. Observation number 5, Paul is deeply concerned in this whole section that everyone learn and be edified. So I just tell you, I cannot believe, this is where I just put my feet down and say, I cannot believe that Paul is saying, if women have any questions, don't ask them in church. Go home and ask your husband. Because the whole point of this is that the truths of the gospel are being articulated so that people can learn from them and be edified by them and encouraged by them. And I just don't believe that Paul is saying it is inappropriate for a woman to say, you know, like at the end here where when people ask questions. Is Paul saying only the men should ask questions and then you should go back and explain it to your wives when you get home? That it is inappropriate for any women to ask me questions here? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. I just can't understand why Paul would say a thing like that, because the whole point of this is that everyone be edified, everyone learn. So I think this has to be tied to the situation that he's talking about. And so given that the issue is not being subject, not submitting themselves to presumably the male leadership, somehow or another, their questioning here represents some sort of challenge to the idea that they have a submission that they ought to give. Now, how do we put that together? Is it, well, it depends on what we see the situation as being. But I think somehow they're going home and questioning their husbands. It's actually a fairly strong word that's used there. I think the idea is more, for instance, it might be that in this situation, the women have taken it upon themselves to challenge the decisions or authoritative, the proclamations that the men have made. It may be related to prophecy, as we'll talk about here in a minute. It could be that the leadership has set certain guidelines for how things are going to happen when they get together and the women don't like it, or I don't know. But somehow they are disrupting the process by not subjecting themselves. That's very interesting. We should talk about that. I won't talk about it now, but that's a very interesting phenomenon, actually. By not subjecting themselves, somehow they are disrupting things by their speaking out. And what they should do instead is, look, basically he's saying, if you've got a problem, you go home and give your husband a bad time about it at home. Basically, you question him there. It is something about the way you're doing this is being disruptive. Now, how to exactly put it together is a challenge. Okay, my final observation is that somehow this section needs to fit into the overall context. One way that has been argued is that, and this may be right, previously Paul talked about prophets being judged and evaluated by the others in the congregation. So you could argue that perhaps the decision, do we as a congregation recognize what this is said as the truth that we ought to abide by, it could be argued that that's the sort of decision that what Paul would refer to as the elders in other places ought to make, those who are in a position to maturely decide what is it that we believe and are a part of in this congregation, and that ultimately the responsibility rests with them, and that the women are taking it upon themselves to dispute and argue, no, we ought to be taking that as real prophecy or that sort of thing. And so the way it fits into here is that the disruption is women fighting for the right to set the leadership direction of the church vis-a-vis the question of what prophets are we listening to or something like that. That's one way of putting it together. I'm not arguing that is the way to put it together, but it is one way that has been proposed, and it might work. Otherwise, maybe there's some other sort of issue that is happening. Something is going on that has the women promoting disorder and frustrating the goal of edification for the group by speaking up in a way that they should not be speaking up. That's what I understand. If we're going to make any sense out of this at all, looking at all of the different pieces that I was pointing to, I think it has to be something along those lines. Therefore, what we see in that is This passage, although it sounds like it, if you just take it out and don't think about how it fits into the whole thing and don't observe it carefully, it sounds like Paul is giving us a new piece of advice for women. This is a unique place in that it's saying to women, basically, you, if you're going to submit to God, you have no right to speak in church at all. Well, my argument would be this is not giving us a new piece of advice about women. It is basically an application to their situation of the same thing that we've been seeing all along in Paul's attitude towards women. That is, there are certain areas and certain ways in which it is appropriate for a woman to recognize the prior responsibility of her husband for the direction that the group is taking. Something along those lines. So this doesn't really come along and tell us anything new. What it exactly says to the Corinthians depends on what it is that's going on there. And since I don't know exactly what was going on there, it's hard to say exactly what he is correcting. But I think it has to be something along the lines of what I've described here. So is this saying that women can't talk in church? The bottom line is no. It is not saying that women can't talk in church, even though it says women can't talk in church. Okay. Now, let me just make a comment about that. I don't want to go on too much about this, but you understand, I think it is essential that we not come along and discard. We don't throw away things in the Bible just because we find them uncomfortable. And if, in fact, Paul believed that women should not speak in church and could explain to us why it was that would be the case, we ought to submit to that. As we're about to see, Paul has a very high view of his authority, and so should we. What I've just done with that passage is I'm not trying to explain it away. And since, let's be honest here. Since it's talking about limiting what women can do, what incentive do I have to not see it that way? I still get to talk. You know, if that's what Paul says, I get to show up and say whatever I want. It's the women that have to be quiet. So it's not like I'm panting to find some way to get out of it. But what I'm looking for is something that makes sense. It has to make sense in the context. What's it doing here with these other things? It has to make sense of the words that Paul actually uses. It has to make sense with the other things that he said about women and subjection and that kind of thing. So when you put it all together, I would argue something like what I've been saying is the way to take the Bible most seriously. I am assuming that Paul is rational, that his thoughts make sense, that he actually is saying something that is coherent. Now, maybe I've gotten it wrong, but in the end, what we decide to do based on what he said should be based on taking him seriously and not ignoring the various clues that would tell us how does this all fit together. So that's what I'm arguing for. I'm not trying to get out of anything. We don't want to take that approach. Okay, he concludes by saying, "Or did the word of God go forth from you, or has it come to you only? If anyone thinks he is a prophet or spiritual, let him recognize that the things which I write to you are the Lord's commandment. But if anyone does not recognize this, he is not recognized." Now, this is very interesting to me. This helps us to see something about the dynamic that's going on here. This is a conclusion, I think, not just to what was immediately before it, but basically to Paul's whole set of advice that he's been giving them about this problem of the spiritual manifestation. The problem regarding tongues and prophecy and spiritual gifts in general represents another area where some in Corinth are fighting Paul. He is at least aware of the possibility, and I think more than just the possibility, he is aware that there are those in Corinth who are promoting the kind of speaking in tongues and preoccupation with the spiritual manifestations that Paul is trying to damp down and put in perspective, and that those people are basically his opponents. It's the same group that has been fighting him on a number of issues, as we see all through the book. So Paul is basically concluding this section by saying, look, you guys, are you going to fight me on this too? Are you the only ones that God is speaking to? Is your church the only church? Let me remind you, I, Paul, am the apostle, the one through whom God is speaking. And you are just one of many churches I have proclaimed the word of God to. If you are going to claim to be a prophet, then you had better recognize my authority. The things that I am telling you are not just my opinion, they represent my authoritative application of the Word of God. They come ultimately from the Lord Himself. There is no question what my authority is. The only question is whether you recognize it or not. If you do not recognize my authority, then you will not be recognized. What he's saying is that you may want to put this as a battle of, well, we're prophets and Paul says this, but we know better that we ought to be like this. But I'm telling you, I'm not going to let it stand on those terms. I'll tell you how I look at the situation. I am an apostle, one to whom the word of God has come, and the things that I am saying to you are the Lord's commandment. Ultimately, Jesus himself has given me my understanding of the gospel, and I am taking that understanding and applying it to your situation. It's not debatable what I'm talking about here. The question of whether God is a God of disorder or not is not a question that is open to discussion. It's not that, well, I think that he is not a God of disorder, but you think he's really into disorder, and we each have our opinion, but after all, I'm a prophet too, so they can listen to me. That's not the way it is. What I'm telling you is the truth. I know it. I have been given it. If you're going to claim to be a prophet, then you're going to recognize God is not over there telling you, don't listen to Paul. That's what I'm telling you. I mean, that's the claim I'm making. God has spoken to me. I am speaking with the authority of Jesus. If you set yourself up against me, that's what you're setting yourself up against. You're disputing. You are saying to God, God, you did not give authority to Paul. He is not speaking for Jesus. Well, Paul's saying, I am speaking for Jesus. And so, in order for me or anyone else to recognize you as a prophet, you have to recognize the authority that I have. And it is interesting to note that Paul sees the prophets here in a subordinate place authoritatively to himself as an apostle. He doesn't say, oh, yeah, you know, you guys are a prophet, God's speaking to you, you might be right, I might have gotten it wrong, maybe I should listen to you because God has spoken to you and maybe I've misunderstood. He says, no, I have understood. What I'm saying is the Lord's commandment. The only question is whether what you're saying is bogus or lines up with the truth that I have told you. That's the question. That's the issue. If you don't recognize my authority, then no one's going to recognize you. I don't recognize you as a prophet. No one should recognize you as a prophet. You can claim that you're speaking for God, but it's wrong. It's just not true, because I am speaking for God. So he finishes up here. Therefore, my brethren, be zealous to prophesy, and do not forbid to speak in tongues, but let all things be done properly and in an orderly manner. So Paul's practical application is this, and as I've been saying all along, he says, look, you guys, I know you're hot for these spiritual manifestations. You think it's great when the Spirit has got all kinds of stuff coming out of your mouth, and you just think that this is really hot stuff. But let's put this in perspective. Since the goal is edification for everyone, if you're going to be hot for spiritual manifestations, be the hottest for those spiritual manifestations that involve edification, that is prophecy, where ideas are being communicated that people can be encouraged by. Tongues, they're okay, but they have no place in the assembly unless there is translation that articulates what it is that's being said, so again, so that people can be edified by it. And the key is that with all these things, that you approach them from the right perspective, that your goal is to promote order and edification. If what you're doing is not promoting order and edification, if it's not making it more possible for people to hear the truth and be edified by it, then you're taking the wrong approach. Okay, I have a couple of comments to make then. First of all, I want to make a comment about, as we look at chapters 12 through 14, and especially the stuff we were just looking at, we have to think about what sort of book the Bible is. Because notice that some of the things in these passages are difficult to sort out. The church has debated greatly over the question of tongues and what exactly is going on in these passages, partly because we don't know what was going on in Corinth. We don't know what Paul knows. We don't know what the Corinthians know about the specific things that are going on there. And that makes it difficult to get specific about certain things. What we want the Bible to be is a rule book that comes along and says, look, here's the deal. Speak in tongues like this. Women, you can do this. You can't do this. I mean, we want it to come along and say, tell me precisely what it is that I'm supposed to do. If you've ever tried to put together something from an instruction manual that was written in Korea or something like that and was translated by somebody that doesn't know English very well, you know, you have that phenomenon where I have this vague idea of what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not exactly sure because they haven't succeeded in communicating it to me. Well, if I think of the Bible as that kind of instruction manual, A, B, C, do it like this, it's not a very good instruction manual at this spot. That little thing about women being silent in there, that's tough however you look at it. I mean, what kind of instruction manual is this? But I would argue that, in fact, what we see is that God has something different in mind as to what sort of a book the Bible is for us. The Bible is a rich source of perspective and general principles out of which we work out the specific details of our lives. I think 1 Corinthians 12 through 14 is a perfect example. The principles are very clear. You could do a lot in your life if you just thought about and meditated on and came to really grasp the basic principles that Paul is talking about in this section. It's very rich in that way. Even as we are left with certain questions about the details, about what was going on in Corinth, so what exactly is the practice of tongues and that sort of thing. But I think that's the way God wants it to be. He has left us with this depository of ideas that we have to kind of, we work on, we massage, we get this clearer and clearer picture of the general principles out of which we're living and making decisions and so on. And it's not like I just pull out a verse and say, okay, this is what it says to do. I am putting together a picture of the world. So it doesn't bother me that I come to this passage and I'm still unclear in some ways about what specifically tongues was or prophesying was or that sort of thing. And we may never be entirely clear in this life as to what was going on there. We may never agree totally together on what exactly constitutes genuine prophecy and that sort of thing. But we have a very strong set of principles within which to evaluate what we're doing on those details. We may not agree whether one particular person has manifested the genuine practice of tongues or the genuine practice of prophecy, but we can agree on what we are supposed to be about, on what the goal of our interaction is, of what we're trying to accomplish. And that takes us a very long way. So I think God is quite content with a certain amount of ambiguity at certain spots that we have to wrestle with. It's not that we don't care what it says. We care very much what it says, but we really have to chew on it a bunch to try to figure out what it's saying there. But in the meantime, while we're doing that chewing, we have a great set of guidelines and principles that are very clear and that speak to us in no uncertain terms. And I think that's the sort of thing that the Bible is meant to be to us. Second comment I wanted to make was just to remind us what Paul was saying at the end there about his authority. I run into people all the time who say they believe in Jesus, but they don't like Paul much. I mean, Jesus is all about love and Paul, yeah, okay, he's got one good chapter, chapter 13, talks about love. But he's such a gripe, you know, in the rest of it, nitpicking all this justification by faith and all this theology stuff. And boy, I mean, look at, he's getting people's cases. I want you to be quiet over here, and I want you to be quiet over here. I mean, what kind of guy is this? Well, Paul is saying, what I'm speaking to you are the commandments of the Lord. And when Paul says the Lord, usually who he means is Jesus. So Paul's claim is, I was taught by Jesus, I got my stuff from Jesus, I am applying for you the truths that Jesus brought into the world, I am his representative. That's what he's claiming. Me and Jesus are saying the same thing. Now, obviously Jesus knows it even better than I do, but I'm saying that he taught me, and what I'm telling you is the truth in the stuff. So we don't really have the option, from Paul's perspective, of saying, yeah, Jesus is great, but Paul's not so hot. I mean, Paul is confronting us with this choice. He is saying, I am the spokesman for Jesus. And if we deny that, if we say, well, I'm not so sure about this part, I don't like that, we are making a profound decision about what it is we are willing to see as authoritative. And Paul is saying, Jesus wouldn't like it. Jesus wouldn't say, oh, thanks for liking me. If you don't like what I'm saying, you're missing something about what Jesus is saying, because we're saying the same thing. And then one last comment here. What we have seen in 12 through 14, I think Paul is addressing a fundamental kind of selfishness and self-centeredness that can creep into religious practices. The things we do as practitioners of our religion can often be incredibly focused on ourselves. The speaking in tongues and saying, hey, I'm hot because I speak in tongues, and you're not hot because you don't speak in tongues, and all of that. All of those issues that Paul has been addressing arise out of the fact that we can take the things of religion and make them very personally satisfying in a way that ignores the needs and situation of other people. I can use it as a self-gratifying thing that basically ignores my obligation to care about the edification and encouragement of other people. I'm going to show off my speaking in tongues even if chaos ensues and I split the church in the process. I'm going to shout out my prophecy even if the other guy's trying to shout out his prophecy at the same time, because I'm a prophet. That's what I do. I've got the floor. I think it's very important for us to recognize that religion and its trappings can be very seductive. That just because you call it worshiping Jesus doesn't make it worshiping Jesus if what is motivating it is fundamentally my desire to gratify myself regardless of the effect that I'm having on the people around me. And, you know, Paul has been speaking to that issue in one way or another throughout the whole letter. Remember what he was talking about with the issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols. The same thing was going on there. You think about what impact you're having on the people around you. So I just think it's very important for us to recognize that just because I can say that I'm doing something that is about Jesus does not justify it as a practice. What justifies it is that it fits within a picture of my obligation to love and encourage and support the people around me. Okay. Oh, man. Well, we got started kind of late this morning. I'm going to take one or two questions if you'd like. But we do have to finish up quickly because the kids came back in and I hear the chaos. So we're anti-chaos around here and there's chaos happening back there. So we can't let that happen. But any?
I don't know if you've ever been in a group prayer situation where everybody's praying out loud and Sally is praying and Kathy is in the group and she says, Lord, please forgive me for thinking that Kathy is a creep.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that the purpose of the prayer is
right.
To let
right.
Kathy know that Sally thinks she's a creep.
Right.
And I'm wondering if the kind of thing that Paul talks about immediately after the woman should keep silent and question her husband's at home, where he's talking about you're a prophet with a little p, but I'm a prophet with a big P, so don't think, you know, we're on an equal standing here, and you need to take me seriously because I was talked by Jesus. If maybe that gives a hint as what's going on with the women is previously they were not in a situation where they could speak at all, and now they're in this situation where they actually are able to pray out loud and prophesy and that kind of thing. And they have got, they've actually got some standing now that they didn't have before, and they've got a beef with their husband, and they're going to do it in your face to my husband by getting a prophet, sort of a kind of a passive aggression thing, where I've just received a word from the Lord that he wants me to have a new couch, that new couch that I saw at Brenner's for $900, it's made of the micro suede. You know, that the whole purpose of doing it is the ostensible purpose is I just got a revelation from God, but the real purpose is in your face to my husband, and to make the point, look, you know, you may be my husband, but now I'm a prophet, and the whole point of this is to say I am not subject to you. I have my own relationship with God, and he's giving me my own revelations, and not only that, the revelations he's giving me countermand what you actually want. And so what Paul is actually saying is, you have a beef with your husband, you go home, you settle it with your husband at home, and let me remind you that if we're talking about who has the primary authority for this particular relationship, it is your husband. Just because you potentially can be a prophet and receive from the Lord, this does not say that you are no longer under the authority of your husband and you don't have to deal with him as such.
It's possible. It has advantage. I mean, it does explain the connection in some ways. The part I stumble over is, how do we understand Paul's decision to put it in terms immediately of saying that the women should not speak? And I'm inclined to see a whole category of things happening that they should not be saying, as opposed to when you're prophesying, limit yourself to this sort of thing as opposed to another thing. It's just a little hard for me to see him putting it in those terms, but it's possible. I think there are several things we could propose that might fit the situation, and you're just trying to make it so that all the little indicators, the one that seems to fit the best is the one that makes all of the phrases sound as plausible as they can be. And it's challenging. But that's not bad.
So could you summarize again what your understanding of the they should not speak means?
Well, like, for instance, I'm not sure that this is the case, but the explanation that says the issue is they were pushing themselves forward in that process where the elders were evaluating the speech of the prophets, basically, they should not speak. That is, in that situation, it is not their place to do that. It is the elders' place to do that, and they're not elders. And it's a man-woman thing that they're not elders in that spot. And I'm not sure that's the case. I'm not saying that is the issue, but at least that's what I mean by a category of speech. In this case, you should just not speak. But I think we'd better... Yeah, one more, and then okay. I'll try to make some. You don't believe me? I always say I'll try to make some room, and I have a lot to try to not say next week too. So I will. Maybe we should just have one big question and answer session right at the very end. Toby, go ahead. Quick. Then we got to stop.
Well, what I'm really grateful for is that, you know, we don't really fall into that whole religiosity thing. I mean, we don't have tongues. So we just humbly sit around and read our Bibles out of Greek, Look, there's a microphone, and I can ask you questions that I already really know the answers to, but it might be for the benefit of other people, and it makes me sound really, really smart.
Yeah, it's a good question, too.
I can make observations about, you know, your sermon or challenge what you say, and it makes me look pretty good, and, you know, so that was just my question.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I'm grateful for that, too. Okay.